Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Stagecraft is brought to you by the Geffen Playhouse. At once humorous and heartrending, Ironbound spans 22 years to tell the story of Daria, a Polish immigrant getting by on a cleaning job, aggressive pragmatism, and sheer will. A New York Times critic's pick, Ironbound features Tony Award-nominated actress Marin Ireland reprising her off-Broadway role alongside Josiah Banya, Christian Camargo, and Marcel Spears. Begins January 30th. Tickets at geffenplayhouse.org. You're listening to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you in-depth interviews with the creators and stars behind the hottest shows on Broadway and beyond. I'm your host, Variety's theater editor, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to Keegan-Michael Key, the actor-writer who co-headlined the buzzy Comedy Central sketch comedy series Key and Peele, and who over the last year has appeared on the New York stage in two very high-profile projects. First, he played Horatio opposite Oscar Isaac in Hamlet at the Public Theater, and he's currently wrapping up the limited run of the smash Broadway comedy Meteor Shower, starring Amy Schumer. He's in the studio to talk with me about working on Broadway, how sketch comedy helps his traditional stage work, and his upcoming gigs playing alien bait and a hyena. Hi, Keegan. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Gordon. Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
Over the last year, you've done two pretty big plays back to back. How'd that happen?
I was lobbying hard to do some theater, and
why?
Because it's my home. It really is my home. I had no intention of ever doing television or even cinema. It was a dream that I might do it, but I knew that I'd be perfectly satisfied. I'd be poor and fulfilled,
right? Because you studied theater, right?
Both yes,
in college
degree,
and you have a BFA,
a BFA and an MFA,
right.
Yeah.
And that was from
BFA from University of Detroit Mercy and my MFA from Penn State.
Okay.
And I got out of school and I auditioned for the Illinois Shakespeare Festival. Right. I was going to do some Marivaux there.
Oh.
And I was going to do Game of Love and Chance by Marivaux. And I was
right.
And then I think maybe I was going to be in A Winter's Tale or Love's Labour's Lost. I can't remember which one. And I was very excited about it and I got cast. And then a friend of mine she was going to graduate school here in New York at Columbia. And she, as her thesis, wanted me to do her independent film. She didn't want to do a short. She wanted to do a feature. So I there was a fork in the road and I chose to make the feature. It was a drama. And much to my chagrin, everybody in the cast of the film kept on telling me how funny I was. Much to my chagrin.
So
I'm a classically trained actor.
Yeah.
How dare you? But I had always had an interest in comedy, you know, since I was probably 14 and saw Eddie Murphy and were like, what's happening there? What's that? Amongst other comedic endeavors.
Sure.
And so I that's why I wanted to do theater. I just figured I would do this Shakespeare Festival and then I would try to do the circuit. I'd do Utah and Colorado and one day maybe I'd even get to perform at Ashland at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. So that was my it's always been my love. Shakespeare classics, from O'Neill to Ibsen to Ionesco to Shakespeare, that's always been my love. And then all of a sudden my life took this little 19-year detour into sketch comedy.
And so when was the last time you were on stage?
The last time I was on stage, I did a musical comedy at the Chicago Shakespeare Theater in the summer of 2004 after my first season at Mad TV.
Okay.
Loved it. Chicago Shakespeare Theater in their studio space, which is a fantastic place to perform.
Yeah.
So that was the last thing I did, really properly did on stage.
Yeah. And so then what, to your mind, are the differences and similarities in your work in sketch comedy and your work in traditional theater? How does one feed the other, and how is one different?
I think that the way that they're similar, of course, is that you're learning text. You are learning text, and you're trying to interpret the work of the writer to the best of your ability. You're also, frankly, trying to get something out of it yourself emotionally. But at the end of the day, the most important thing for you to do is to tell the story. the difference, the obvious difference, is the length,
right?
And what lies therein is that everything's happening at an accelerated rate in sketch. So the who and the what and the where usually come out as fast as possible, and that's where we always find the delicious challenge of how do you do that without being clunky? How do you show environment and the relationship between two people and why they're there and what they're trying to achieve in 6 minutes? Let's say a sketch is 6 minutes. You have to do that in about 90 seconds to 2 minutes, and that's part of that craft. Right. Whereas a playwright has just a little bit more time, a little more luxury to set that up. Right. So sometimes, as an example, I'm doing Meteor Shower right now. There's 14 scenes in the play. The first scene is about 8 minutes long. So that's 4 minutes longer than any self-respecting sketch should be.
Right. Right.
And you get to set up other characters through the exposition of these two characters.
Right.
So that's the screamingly biggest difference.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And what do you feel like people who have experience doing sort of sketch comedy bring to traditional theater now that you're doing it after having so many years in sketch comedy?
I think what you bring is a kind of welcome, devil may care attitude, and a freedom and an irreverence. And I think that it allows you to be, or at least crave, you start to crave moments that you can sculpt that will be what we call in the sketch world green lights. So you're saying the lines, you're honoring all the punctuation that the playwright painstakingly picked, but you're going to do it in as free and as spontaneous a way as you can, because you've had that fix of sketch for years or improv, which is actually creating everything in a moment. Right. So I want to create everything in a moment in this setting. So I think you bring this almost, all right, I'm going to say your words, but I've got to be able to make a different face. I've got to try to organically get a reaction out of the other performer, right, which is much easier to do in improv because we don't know what's coming out of my mouth next. Right. The other thing that's helpful about it that dovetails is that I know, as a person who performed nothing but improvisation and sketch for 6 straight years, I know the sensation I have when a person is actually affecting me. And then sometimes I feel like walking over to the other performer and go, whatever you did there, try to do some variation of that every night. But don't do that every night.
Right.
Do some
right.
variation of that every night.
Right. Were you aware of that affecting your rapport either in rehearsal and in performance with Amy, who obviously has a similar kind
background.
Of experience,
uh-huh, uh-huh.
right? And this, like, you know, I imagine comfort level with improvisation and spontaneity. Like, did you notice that in the rehearsal room in terms of how you two worked together and with others?
It worked. I didn't notice it as much. It was subtler in the rehearsal room than it was in actual performance. Once we started previews and we started to get our show legs, which would be the middle of the second week of previews, we had a nice, long, delicious preview process, 3 weeks of previews, which I think every comedy should have. And I'd say halfway through the second week of previews, or the beginning of the third week, is when Amy's stand-up experience started kicking in. So she's hearing the laugh, and you see her start crafting lines differently to you and crafting lines for the audience. Trying to get the zigs and the zags as sharp as possible so we can get the most, they can get the most out of the reaction and we can get the most out of the reaction.
Right.
So I noticed it more in performance than I did in the rehearsal process. But it's definitely happening in that irreverence that comes from the sketch and stand-up performers is definitely in this performance. I don't think there are a lot of performances on Broadway right now that are this fluid.
What, for all of you? Is that
for all of us?
Okay.
There are, and everybody approaches it in a different way. Laura is deliciously and gloriously reactive to whatever Amy gives her. I try to be reactive to whatever Amy gives me. Jeremy has been very
surgical.
This is
Jeremy Shamus,
Jeremy Shamus has been very surgical. There are lines that have been improvised in front of a live audience that Steve Martin has now put into the script.
Oh, wow.
Because we are trying, I will say this, full disclosure, we are trying to trip each other up, and I welcome it because it keeps it fresh. Right. Because the characters in the play, at any given time, depending on what point you are in the play, are trying to trip each other up. So why not have the actors try to trip each other up in subtle ways that always keeps us on our toes? It's the best kind of frightening. And so Jeremy is very surgical. It's like it would take him 3 weeks, and then one day he'd go, I think I'm going to say this tonight after I say that.
Does he warn you?
Yeah, he warns me. Well, there's not many moments we're all off the stage, but there's one moment where he and I are off the stage for a good collected amount of time, which is usually 3 minutes. In Hamlet, we'd have 15 to 20 minute breaks. Yeah. And he would say, I think I'm going to say this tonight. I'm going to say X after I say Y. Then other nights he would say, you know what? I'm not going to say X or Y. I'm just going to say Z. Oh, tonight I'm going to put the cup here and do this thing, but I'm not going to tell Laura. And then Laura would come off stage and then I'd tell Laura. So I'd be tricking them. And then when you didn't get the reaction. So the audience is watching humans really trying to trip each other up and going, oh, you didn't get me. Wait a minute. Why didn't I get her? So they're seeing genuine confusion and genuine delight and genuine expression on stage. That's what they actually paid for.
Yeah, right. And of course, crowds have been huge. It's a sold out smash.
We broke a record for pre-sales at the Booth Theater.
How's that been with the audience, both in the show and at the stage door? How's that?
It's one of the great pleasures of my life. I go to the stage door and sign every night. And it's lovely because you see this look in people's eyes where they just go, yeah, you're that guy. I'm touching you. That's the guy who's from the substitute teacher sketch. You know what I mean?
Right.
But what they just saw, I think, is even more special. Or I should say, I'm sorry. It's special in a different way. And everyone's been so lovely and gracious. And I'm so grateful for it. So grateful for that expression. In the theater, the most glorious thing about theater, right, is that it's different every night. Some nights, Jeremy and I have a small respite. We finish a scene, and then he and I go around the back of the stage, and we sit in these two chaise lounges, in a chaise lounge, and we just kind of start to analyze how the show's going so far before we come back on stage. And which you can do after 2 months. You don't do that after a week.
Yeah.
Like last night, he was going, they're good tonight. I was like, yeah, they're explosive tonight. And then the next night, ooh, they're really rolling. They're very rolly, quote, R-O-L-L-Y audience. So they're rolling. The laughter's rolling back like a wave. Ooh, tonight, ooh, what's going on? Ooh, the front part of the house seems to be really boisterous, and the back part of the house seems to be contemplative. It's lovely because it's different every night.
Right.
Yeah.
And obviously you're working with Steve Martin as well. What's he been like?
Steve lives a very considered life. Steve is very interesting. He's very self-reflective. So if you and he also is never at rest, and I think like a good artist should be, he's never satisfied. That's why he's still, we have 3 weeks left of this show, and he's just the other day he emailed me and said, I put those two lines that you ad-libbed into the script. Now who knows, Gordon, he may cut those lines and put other lines back or do a combination thereof. Right. In the next week, he never stops, and so it's lovely. He has a very quiet, as I said, quiet, considered drive.
Yeah,
yeah.
Reading the play for the first time, was there anything? Did it surprise you as something that was the work of Steve Martin? Did you know his playwriting before, or did you?
I'm not super familiar with Picasso, Le Panagile. Mm-hmm. I'm not super familiar with it. This play, you could see little moments, little linchpin moments here and there. We go, ah. Only Steve Martin could have written that. Only Steve Martin could have written that. And I think it smacked of Steve Martin, the whole piece. I felt like the way he's such an intellectual, that the way he framed the relationships and the theme of the play seemed very Martin-esque.
And so for the people who haven't had a chance to see it yet, it's about these two couples who get together to watch a meteor shower in the backyard. And it starts out very... like a realistic comedy, and then it takes a very
absurd.
Several very surreal, absurd turns. Did you have the talk with Steve where he says, you guys, this is what's happening in this play? Like, is there an interpretation of this play that he bestowed upon you?
He didn't. There are two previous productions of this play,
right.
And I think he really wanted this to have its own stamp. From what I can glean from conversations I've had with him and Jerry Zaks, this is
the director, Jerry
Zaks. This version is a little wackier, a little zanier than previous versions. I just gleaned this from these conversations. So it has a crowd pleasing quality to it, but it also there was lots of discussion about how obviously do we map out the theme or display the theme. And I think we found the right balance for it. But yes.
I was just going to ask you what's your take on what the play is about.
Well, first of all, after about a week into rehearsal, Laura and I looked at each other one day and we said, okay, so we're not humans.
Right.
I know I'm
probably, spoiler.
Yeah, spoiler.
Spoiler alert, yeah.
Or there is something definitively archetypal that we're doing that maybe Jeremy and Amy aren't necessarily doing or isn't required of them. Yet, let's play it with real stakes, like real humans, with real honesty in the midst of this absurdist framework. And so to answer your question, I think the theme is what does a couple do, or how do they marshal their own forces? How do they batten down their emotional hatches when they come against some kind of trouble in their marriage, when they see the tide coming or they're caught in the tide of something, whether it be too much ego or a lack of confidence or whatever it happens to be? How do they navigate that difficulty in their relationship? That's, I believe, the theme of the piece, if you're looking at it from a purely intellectual point of view.
Right. We'll return in a moment with more from Keegan-Michael Key right after this. Stagecraft is brought to you by the Geffen Playhouse. At once humorous and heartrending, Ironbound spans 22 years to tell the story of Daria, a Polish immigrant getting by on a cleaning job, aggressive pragmatism, and sheer will. A New York Times critic's pick, Ironbound features Tony Award-nominated actress Marin Ireland reprising her off-Broadway role alongside Josiah Banya, Christian Camargo, and Marcel Spears. Begins January 30th. Tickets at geffenplayhouse.org. And we're back, talking to Keegan-Michael Key on Stagecraft.
And so Hamlet was also a giant hit with packed houses, but the house was a much smaller one. Mm-hmm. I think it's less than 300 people, that theater of the public, right? Do you have a preference in terms of what kind of crowd you're playing in front of? What size, rather?
At this very moment, I would say I prefer the larger crowd, and I prefer, at this moment, performing on that proscenium stage. Hmm. I kind of like really throwing myself into my fellow performers. I cannot see the audience that well, so great. I hear them.
Yeah, we should say that in Hamlet, you is a thrust stage, and
thrust stage.
Everyone can see everyone.
Everybody can see. Yeah, you can see faces in the back row.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it was a very immersive experience. But there were days, I'll admit, there were days where I would get caught in someone's face for a minute and then go, okay, get back to character, you know. Whereas here, I really feel that small gulf between the front of the apron and the first row allows me to really be with Amy and Jeremy and Laura. And I can't see anybody in the mezzanine. I can't see anybody, I can barely see anybody in the orchestra. So I'm really wrapped up in what my fellow performers are doing. And I prefer that right now. There were times where you felt like those people at the Ansbacher were part of the court. And I'm sure Sam Gold, who directed the piece, wanted to have some sense of that. Right. You saw that show.
Yeah.
So you saw how the red carpet that comes down off the risers just looks exactly like the red carpet on the stage.
Yep.
Clearly intentional.
Yep.
And so it felt a little off-putting and obtrusive, but I used that. It was a very off-putting, obtrusive experience for Horatio.
Yes. Did you enjoy being back using your classical training to the fullest of its? When was the last time you had done a project that you considered using your classical training?
Oh gosh, I think I did a play in Detroit, my hometown, at the Attic Theater. It might have been the last show ever at the Attic Theater in Detroit. Did we call it Shakespeare's Greatest Hits? I can't remember what it was called, but it was. And I did some wonderful piece that was written by some guys from Beyond the Fringe. It was written by like Cook and Moore and all those guys that were in England in that tradition, the Goon Show and Beyond the Fringe.
Right.
And they wrote this piece that smashed all of Shakespeare's histories together. And there were a few lines that I was doing in trochaic octameter, like iambic hexameter and trochaic or dactylic octameter. It was obnoxious. You're like 700 feet, you know? And right. And that was like 2000, that was like maybe 97 or 98. So it was right after I got out of school.
Okay.
And it was glorious. I've been looking for that piece ever since, and I've not been able to find it. But other than that, school.
Right. And so Hamlet was a good experience for you.
It was a dream come true.
It remind me, I'm having trouble remembering for people who didn't get a chance to see the show, it was a very sort of
I don't know, hotel conference room bland. Yeah, like, it looked, sort of aesthetic.
That's a, yes, it looked very like a cross between a rundown Catholic church social hall.
Ooh, that's solid. Yeah, that's a good description.
Yeah, with carpet.
Right.
A rundown
right.
Catholic yeah. church social hall with carpet. Yes. But
there was quite a bit of potting soil and mm-hmm. quite a bit of water mm-hmm. and ultimately quite a lot of mud. And I'm having trouble remembering how muddy you got. I know some of your co-stars got like drenched.
Oh, drenched in mud. Yeah. I was left almost unscathed, like one side of my shirt and my knee.
Right. Right.
Yes, as opposed to Anatole Youssef and Oscar Isaac, who were look like mud monsters.
Yep. Yeah.
So I was left relatively unscathed by the mud.
And so, what for you was how did that approach to that non-traditional approach to staging the piece affect? Do you think what Hamlet was about for you and what it was about for your performance?
I think it made Hamlet very raw and personal for me. I was encouraged throughout the rehearsal process, and I was invited to not use my Shakespeare voice. Sam Gold, he's like, Keegan, you're kind of softening those R's, and I hear the verse a little bit. And then one day, eventually, he just kind of put his foot down and said, I don't want to hear verse. I want you guys rendering it as colloquially as you can. I want you to stop where you feel the sentence stops. And I want you to sound like Keegan from the Midwest, from Michigan, who's saying these words and they make sense to him. Do that for me, please. Hmm. And I went, oh, no. I was hiding behind Shakespeare
voice. It's like the opposite of your training, right?
Yes, well, but also from a personal point of view, I'm hiding behind the verse. I'm hiding behind the verse. I don't want to give you all of me. And Sam's like, hi, I want all of you. And so it became intensely personal. Oscar and I became very close and are very close. And it was I keep using this word glorious, but that's been the experience of the last like 6-7 months of my life. Right. It's been glorious because I couldn't achieve what the director wanted if I didn't get naked, if I didn't get emotionally naked. And I appreciated him using every trick in his book to pull that out of me. And I said, okay, so we're going here for my first trip back to Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And it's funny, I have conversations with people and they'd go, so wait a minute, you're telling me that 4 hours straight. All right. So a friend of mine who was English, and he had just done a Hamlet in less than a decade ago. And he said, do you have any cuts? And I said, oh, we cut everything with Fortinbras. And he looks at me and goes, you cut Fortinbras, but it's 4 hours long. And he's trying to, and he's like, how can it be 4 hours long? And he goes, we did it with Fortinbras. And it was 3:10. How did you? And I said, because my director has no shame about you taking pauses. Take a pause and feel it. Right. Earn it. Earn the pause, but then pause. I don't. He goes, I don't care. We have to have the luxury of keeping it buoyant and real and accessible. That was the most important thing to Sam. Right. Yeah. And so for me, it felt buoyant and real and immediate and accessible for me, as well as for the 244 people that were sitting there every night.
But also on top of these two shows that you've done, you do a lot of screen work as well. Like you've got this Netflix series that is going back to for its second season Friends
yeah.
and Friends from College. And then you've got a couple of big movies coming out. You in the next year or two, you've got Predator, right?
Right, Predator, yeah.
Which is not a reboot nor a sequel, correct?
It's not a reboot nor a sequel. Shane Black, who directed it, said the biggest way he describes it is it is a film that lives in the world.
Okay.
It should be able to be a standalone film that lives in the universe, in the Alien universe, Predator universe.
Yeah,
because they did smush those two universes together.
Yeah.
Yeah, they conflated them, but they did. They merged them.
And is it funny? Is it a funny scary movie
it has a lot of kind of incidental humor in it. It's very, this is a poor way of describing it, but it's very Shane Black. So if anybody, the humor that existed in Lethal Weapon, the humor that existed in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang,
right.
The humor that existed in...
He wrote Lethal Weapon and wrote and directed Kiss Kiss Bang Bang?
Correct,
right? Okay.
Yes. And he also wrote and produced and directed Nice Guys last year with Russell Crowe,
right.
Which I really enjoyed, a film I really enjoyed. He always tries to create situations in which you'll find humor and occasionally write a nice boffo line.
Right.
This movie has more of the former and less of the latter.
Got it.
And lots of, and something I also enjoy, lots of practical effects. The least amount of CGI possible is what he's trying to do.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, but speaking of CGI, you're also working on the Lion King,
yes.
The live action Lion King.
Yeah.
You play one of the hyenas.
I'm one of the hyenas. Eric Andre and I are one of the hyenas. Yes.
Do you have a song?
We have no song.
Okay.
We actually have no song. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I was.
Have you done it yet? Have you?
I actually have done most of it. And I think what,
and that's all done in a giant soundstage, right?
Yes.
In L.A.
In Los Angeles, yeah. There's just a warehouse in like Marina del Rey,
right?
And you
right.
drive up and you walk in and you sit there and now they have new technology with the cameras. They don't have to put dots on you.
Oh, really?
Yes, they just had 15 cameras and Eric and I had the opportunity to be together to perform off of each other.
I was actually going to ask about that, whether there was anyone else, any other performers in the room with you when you were doing this motion capture.
I did one audio session by myself, yeah. And then a motion capture session with Eric. And really what that room consisted of was us walking around a black floor that had parameters, 15 cameras, and then Jon Favreau, who's directing the film,
yeah.
sitting in the corner.
Who also directed The Jungle Book.
Who also directed The Jungle Book, right, yeah. And this is going to look very much like The Jungle
right.
Book. Sitting in the corner with his eyes closed, listening to rhythm. So he's seeing the hyenas, which may or may not have facial features and facial lineaments that match me and Eric's, right. But you see him seeing it virtually and then stopping and backing up and going, do this again. And then we'd start talking. And I think he said it was very helpful. Very helpful.
Was that fun?
It was an absolute blast. I really enjoy Eric a lot. Yeah. And we have very different voices and there's a different dynamic there.
Yeah.
It gelled really well. It felt good. It worked really well. And I'm really looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah.
I've seen even little test spec stuff and it's going to be gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's going to be gorgeous. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
And how often do you get mistakenly congratulated on Get Out? Does that happen a lot?
It's been decreasing.
Good.
It's been decreasing. It's now happening. It's happening almost nil now. Mm. Right. Once the movie was, It didn't happen at the beginning or the end. No, it didn't happen at the beginning because I was in another country shooting a movie.
Right,
in the middle, five times a day?
Oh.
About a two-week span, five
right.
times a day.
Right.
I love your movie! You know what I mean? I'm like, my fiance sometimes like, it's okay, just wait.
Just take it.
They'll understand.
But you and Jordan are working on or developing something new with Judd Apatow, is that right?
Not with Judd Apatow. Right now, the thing that we're working on is with Henry Selick of James and the Giant Peach fandom and Coraline. He and Jordan are writing something together. It's a dream of Jordan loves stop motion, loves the macabre.
Yeah.
He's doing a project right now. He's doing the new Twilight Zone. They're doing a reboot of Twilight Zone.
Right. Yeah.
So and he's really in his element now. And so I'm going to provide a voice for this project with Henry Selick. I believe we're allowed to talk about it. It's called Wendell and Wild. Mm. And it's based on a graphic novel that Jordan is a big fan of. So they're putting the story together. And I will come on as a producer later and do some, you know, some mixing and matching and some suggesting here and there later. So that's our next project together. And then I've sat with him and talked with him a few times. And they go, what do you think? Everybody I talk to in our business is like, so you know what you should do? Like in 2 years, you guys get back together, do a Netflix schedule special. And I'm like, he's newlywed.
Yeah.
He has a baby.
Yeah.
Let Jordan, he's, you know, just made one of the most successful horror movies in decades.
Yeah.
Let the guy take a breath, right. You know, and then we'll discuss it.
And then so for you, looking at your own career, how much do you balance kind of the work that you want to write and then create in terms with, you know, just being an actor in a getting a gig as an actor and performing someone else's words? What do you think about that?
It's like 80-20 latter to the former. I just assume latter to the latter to I'm sorry, latter to the former.
Yeah.
I just as soon get a call. I really enjoy being a hired gun and being an interpretive artist.
Yeah.
And 20% of me wants to be a generative artist.
Okay.
And I'm working on a project right now that I'm not at liberty to say, it's in such embryonic stages, but I'm working with somebody on a project because the things that I'm interested in doing are, I want to be Jason Bourne or right. some version of Jason Bourne. I want to do espionage movies. I want to be in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. 2. I want to throw my hat in the ring to be the next Bond.
Right.
That's what I want to do.
Right.
And things of that ilk. And so I'm kind of moving headlong into that. I'm moving 100% into that 20%.
Got it.
Yep. if you will. Right. So that's and because I do enjoy cinema quite a lot. I wouldn't mind making like a spy movie that was directed by a Polish person shot in Budapest or Kiev. You know, that's okay. Something I would really enjoy doing that had a real European, a raw European cinema verite sensibility to it. That's something that would really float my boat. And so, yeah, that's kind of that's. But if someone were just to offer me a role in a movie like that, that'd be heaven.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
If I have to make it on my own, I'm happy to do
You're
that
gonna,
as well.
Yeah. Right. Right. And then how do you think about theater as you look ahead?
I think here's a plan. It's a very like sketchy plan I have in my mind. What I'd love to do is I'd love to, you know, bank away enough money a year that I could do a play every other year or every 2 years or every 2 years do two plays. If I could right. do what I just did, gosh, Gordon, would I be happy? Okay. Or if I could do something like a musical or do a nice, lovely, thick, straight play that has some weird, fun elements in it for 6 months,
right.
I'd really like to do that because both of these have been these kind of limited runs. But I wouldn't mind doing back-to-back plays again. And I wouldn't mind doing a classic. I walk out of the theater some days and I'm going down the road as I leave the theater and I look up and two doors down, I think at the Golden, it's not the Schoenfeld, I think at the Golden, is where Denzel Washington is going to do
Iceman
Cometh. And then right next door, Three Tall Women. So you have O'Neill and Albee next to each other. Something in that world would be lovely.
Right, right.
But I got to make the money so I can still live where I want to live.
Yeah. 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 Well, I look forward to seeing what you do on stage next. Well,
me too.
Me too. Thanks for being here. It's
Thanks
great
so
talking
much,
to you.
Thanks so much, this is a real pleasure.
That was Keegan-Michael Key, who's currently finishing up his run in Steve Martin's play Meteor Shower, playing at the Booth Theater through January 21st. On the next episode of Stagecraft, I'll be talking to John Lithgow about the one-man show he's currently performing on Broadway, Stories by Heart. Until then, see you at the theater.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.